I'm Eva Quisha. This is the month of August 1980. I'm staying with my daughter in California, and I take this time to talk about my life story as I remember it. I was born on my father's homestead in the northeast part of Merrick County, about 5 miles north of Silver Creek, Nebraska. My folks lived there. It was typical of Sand Hills. It was a relinquishment that someone else had as a homestead. The buildings were already there. They already looked old because they hadn't been painted. The house was 3 rooms, and the barn had a straw roof, and the cattle shed likewise, and the chicken house, and there was a little granary. That's all the buildings there were on the place. We lived there until after my mother died. Then my grandmother took me, and I stayed with her until my father remarried, and then he took me back to live in the home again. I was born on December 12, 1892. My father's name was Martin Cargis, and my mother's maiden name was Amelia Schultz. They were married on January 27, 1891 at the Catholic Church in Duncan, Nebraska. And then they first made their home on a small farm at the edge of the Sand Hills, north and east of Silver Creek. And later they moved on to this homestead that my dad took up. And shortly after my birth, my mother took sick, and she was sick. Her sickness lasted nearly 3 years when she finally gave up with the fight with cancer. After my mother's death, which occurred on January 18, 1896, I went to live with my grandmother, Mason, and my dad became a bachelor, living alone like a hermit on the prairie. He spent his days doing whatever he could to earn an honest dollar, and he became a cattle herder, took in cattle to pasture, and herded them on the unfenced prairies, were abundant at that time. There were hardly any fences. Everything was prairie, and you could just go wherever you wanted to. You didn't have to follow any road, for there wasn't any. On July 20th, 1897, my father married again. He married a Polish lady, and she had a son about the same age as I. She spoke some English, but the little boy didn't. And you can imagine how we got along. I spoke English and he spoke Polish. Neither one understood the other. If he couldn't get what he wanted, he took it away from me. By that time, we were both school age. I was 5 years old that year. I was eligible to go to school, and Frank, the stepbrother, was also. So we went to school, which begun always in the Sand Hills where we lived. The school begun the first Monday in December and lasted until the end of April. And we walked to school except when it was stormy. Then our dad took us in the wagon. There weren't very many children in the school because there weren't very many people living in the district. There was only 2 other families beside ours that had school children. So most of the time, there was 3 or 4 pupils, and the teacher came from Chapman, Nebraska. She lived with the Cargis family, my family. The teacher's name was Grace Bunker. She taught our school for 3 terms. She became like one of the family. We got to know her so well. My father was born in Germany. He came to the United States when he was a small child, 10 months old. And the family stopped off in Wisconsin, and they lived there for 3 years. My dad often said the climate there was so poor and the milk he drank was so thin that he didn't grow hardly any during the whole while. He wore the same clothes when he left there that he had when he came. So you can imagine how small he was. If he was 10 months old and wore the wore the same clothes for 3 years. It's funny that those clothes lasted that long. But they migrated to Nebraska. They heard about homestead privileges in Nebraska, so they came directly to Duncan, Nebraska, which was then known as a village of Cherry Hill. It was named Cherry Hill because of sand cherries growing on the hills north of the village. By the time they come there, my dad's uncle and aunts were teenagers. They were children when they came from Germany, but the two eldest, married and remained in Wisconsin where they lived in Milwaukee. And the rest and they came with the grandparents, all came, and they lived on a farm for a while until they went on their own. There was one uncle that married and went to live on a farm west of Silver Creek, Nebraska, and my grandmother, she worked as a maid in a farm home, and the other two girls both went to town to Columbus, where they got jobs. Later, they found husbands, and they established their homes in Columbus, Nebraska. And their names, the grandfather's name was John Cargus. That's what I think. That's what I've been told. I don't know what. I think his wife's name was Ann. And their children, one was John, and Ann, and Martin, and my grandmother was Eva, and the other two aunts were Elizabeth and Katie. And Katie married a man named Philip Dietz, and Elizabeth married a man named William Schultz, and my grandmother married a man named William Mason, and the other uncle, Martin, married a lady. Her name was Ann. Her last name was Soam, but she lived only a few years, and she had a daughter by a former marriage. And after her death, Uncle Martin married again, and he married a younger lady, a girl named Ann Cresha. She survived him. She lived for many years. She lived to be 87 years old. And Uncle Martin, as we knew him, we always knew him by Uncle Martin, because that's what our dad knew him. Our dad knew him as Uncle Martin, so everybody called him Uncle Martin. He died at the age of 77. My mother came to America with her family, the John Schultz family, and they were five or six children and with the parents, and more were born later after they were living in Platte County, where they located. They located north of Duncan, Nebraska, on a small acreage near the Loup River. The members of their family were John, Anna, Amelia, Francis, Frank, Joe, Charles, and Laura. Charles was the youngest. John and Anna were the oldest, and where they all came from Austria. That was their native country, and the town was called Hakowitz. When they located on the farm, they didn't have, well, it was just like everybody else. They were pioneers. They only had what they could earn, what they could raise. They engaged in farming, and of course, they had to make do with what they could. They didn't have a whole lot. They had to get along. They were just like all the other pioneers. When Charles, the youngest, was 3 years old, the mother died, and then the father had to finish raising the family. Charles was 3 years old, and Laura was a little older than he, and some of the girls, the oldest girl was married. John wasn't married, and the other boys weren't married yet either. They were all teenagers. But grandfather kept them all together. He wasn't very, very strong. He wasn't very well. He was a cancer victim also. But the boys stayed with him and helped him to get along, to raise the family, and to educate them as was proper in those years. Nobody sent their children to high school. They went to country school. That's what they got along with, the education that they could get in the country school. And John became a farmer. Frank became a carpenter. Joe became a barber. And Charlie became a farmer also. And the girls, well, Mealy became my mother. And Ann married a farmer. And Laura married a farmer. And thus it was. They all married people according to who they associated with, and they all became honest citizens of the country where they lived. Most of them all lived in Nebraska, with the exception of Frances. When she married, she moved to Canada to make her home. Suppose you'd like to know what my parents looked like, their coloring, their temperament, and so on. My mother was an inch taller than my dad. She was 5'9". She had real dark brown hair and dark brown eyes. She was a strongly built person. Being so tall, why, she'd naturally be well built. Farm girls were well built, you know. She was a thoroughly domesticated person, I guess you would say. She loved fancy work. She did fancy knitting, crocheting, and she made some of my clothes had the most perfect buttonholes. And when they told me that my mother made them well, every stitch was in place. I didn't know my mother personally because I was so little. My Aunt Frances wasn't married then yet, and she stayed with us a lot when my mother was sick. Later on, when I got to be older to realize those things, we had a handmade quilt that was made of square pieces, about an inch and a half square, and they circled the quilt round and round and round, and the quilt was the name of the quilt was Trip Around the World. And from that time on, I always kept thinking, I wonder if I'll ever get to make a quilt like that one. Yeah, we had it on our bed. We had it until it wore out, of course. But I always kept thinking about that quilt, and once I saw a pattern, the pattern was advertised in a magazine, I sent for it. And from that time on, why, I always kept thinking about handmade quilts. Of course, I made some in my time, but then, you know, when you're raising a family, you don't have time to sew quilts. You have to see to it that they have clothes to wear, and that the washing is done, and the cooking is done, and whatever. Suppose you want to know about my dad. Well, the first that I can remember my dad, his hair was half gray, but I could tell that his hair was brown, kind of a sandy brown, and he had real bright blue eyes, and he always wore whiskers in the wintertime. He said that he had to do that to keep his face from chapping. So when wintertime came, he wore whiskers. Ma used to tease him that she wanted him to shave like other men did, but he said, other men don't have faces like mine. He said, I wear whiskers for my comfort of my face. And that's what he did. But he, in spite of all the troubles that he had, all the bills and everything, the way he hauled my mother from one doctor to the other during the years when she was sick. She had surgery 3 times, and they went from one doctor to another, hoping to find somebody that could do something to those days, you know. People mistakenly thought cancer could be cured. Well, nobody found a cure for it. Well, everybody kept hoping. And of course, When her time come to die, well, she died. She was 28 years old and a little older. If she'd lived till the following July, she'd have been 29. But she died in January. She was 28 years and some months old. When my dad, the hospitals and everything, he didn't. He had to borrow the money. And Uncle Martin Cargas, his namesake, signed his paper. Then he paid them off one after the other as much as he was able, a little at a time. I was 14 years old when he paid the last doctor bill to a Columbus doctor. The doctor had died and they were settling his estate. And the administrator called on my dad. Couldn't he pay something on it? Well, he says, you know, he says, I'm married, I'm raising a family. And he says, you know, it costs money to raise a family and I have doctor bills too. But he says, I've got some young horses. If you can take those horses on the doctor bill, you're welcome to. So they came out, 2 men on horseback, came out and they took three young horses that hadn't been trained to the harness. They were halter broken, but they weren't trained to the harness, and they drove those horses to Columbus. Those horses went in payment of the last payment of my mother's doctor bill. The doctor's name was William S. Evans. He was in Columbus. He was in Columbus, a doctor there for many years until his death. Maybe I should tell something about my dad's occupation. I mentioned something in my previous talk that he had an occupation of taking in cattle to pasture when he got his patent on his homestead before he married my stepmother. She had filed on 160 acres that was nearby, and so we decided we'd live on, we'd had to live on Ma's homestead for 5 years. So Dad continued his cattle herding occupation, but this time he rented different tracts of land, and he put fences around them and put up windmills. And he always had, in every summer, he'd have a school kid from town make his home with us that ride those fences. They'd ride a different fence. He and my stepbrother Frank was older by then, and he and Frank would ride the fences with staples in their pockets and a hammer, and whenever there'd be staples missing on a post, they'd get off their horse and nail it up, so the cattle didn't get out. And the surrounding areas around there were nobody else had this occupation. So any of this land was owned by people that were in town or wherever that owned the land. Dad would rent it. And, of course, he'd take in cattle, as many as the land he had could pasture. He wanted to make sure that the pasture wouldn't be overgrazed, because he wanted it to be serviceable for next year. So that's what he did. My dad was a hard worker. Beside the cattle occupation, he also had what they call a cream route. 3 days a week, he drove around the surrounding countryside gathering up cream, because people didn't have any cream separators. They had skimmed cream, and there wasn't any cream station in town to buy the cream. So my dad gathered up this cream. He had large cream cans on a big wagon with a wet tarpaulin over the top, and he hauled his cream to a creamery at Genoa, Nebraska. He usually traveled around 25 miles a day. He went different route every day. Once he'd go south, another time he'd go east, another time he'd go north. And he'd always manage to gather that cream and get it up to the creamery before 4 o'clock in the afternoon, because riding a cream wagon drawn with horses, if you was out on the road, that cream would get pretty warm, even if the farmer's wife kept it in a tank and kept it cool. It got pretty warm before he got to Genoa if he didn't travel. So he had some fleet-footed horses, broncos, no less. He'd usually take his lunch along, and he wouldn't take feed for the horses. When noon came, he'd unhitch and feed his horses so they'd travel better, and he'd eat his own lunch, and then he'd go again. Now, you'd probably want to know what sort of person my father was. My father was the most wonderful person in my book, honestly. Nobody was any more than my father. He was the number one person in my book. He was a hard worker. He worked day and night, seemed to me. When he come home, many times he come home, he'd eat supper, he'd hitch up the horses again and take two hay wagons and drive down to where he had some hay bought, because we lived in the sand hills. We didn't have any meadow to make hay. And he had to haul hay. He had to buy hay to feed the cows over winter, to feed the horses over winter. And if we needed grain, that had to be bought. We didn't do any farming whatsoever. About the only planting we did, we had a little garden about as big as our house. And Ma planted a few carrots, a little lettuce and radishes, and anything that had a long growing season. We could never raise any tomatoes because they'd long in July they'd dry up because it was got too hot and dry. So we got along best we could. We always bought the potatoes from Grandma, and we bought cabbage from a lady in near Genoa that raised it, and we'd make sauerkraut, and we'd Dad would always grain feed a beef and butcher it so we'd have meat, and the same way with hogs. We wouldn't, about the only time that Dad bought meat is when he was in town, he'd come home with a soup bone. Believe it or not, you could get a soup bone for a quarter. It was what they call a shank. You could get it for a quarter, and Ma would cook it, and we'd have soup and meat one day, and the next day we'd have meat. There'd be meat left for the next day. Well, you know, our family was small. There was just Dad and Ma, Frank and me, and the hired boy. That's all there was at the table in the summertime, unless one of the uncles came over. Dad had uncles living at home. They'd come up to help make fence, and they would, of course, they'd eat at our table then too. And people those days, nobody went home for meals. If they come to your place to work, well, you invited them to have dinner with you. That was the rule. My dad was that was his rule. I don't care who came there. Many a time we kind of lost patience with him. Some agent had come there trying to sell him something, and he'd be talking his sales talk, of course. Dad invited him to stay for dinner. Ma says, my goodness. Dad invited him for dinner, and we've just got leftovers. But they didn't care. They sat at the table, and they thanked us for the meal, and they was real happy. That sometimes they were people that were used to eating at restaurants. They said, well, when I eat at a restaurant, I know just what I'm going to get, and I know just how it's going to taste. He says, when I eat out in the country, he says, it's something new, and I enjoy it a whole lot, he said. My dad was a loyal family man. His family came first. He looked out for the family, and he always emphasized whatever he told anybody, that honesty was the best policy. You got what you paid for, and you couldn't get something for free unless it was something no one else wanted. And when the children were little, he told them stories. He sang them songs. Often he'd sit in the rocking chair holding the baby. He'd tell stories to the older ones, and he'd sing till the baby fell asleep, and things like that. And he enjoyed himself when he could visit with a neighbor. Ma says, we're not waiting for Pa. He's probably talking to somebody up there on the fence corner. So Ma would put his supper in the warming oven, and we'd go ahead with our supper. Of course, Dad was always there on time at noon, but when he went to town, we didn't wait for him then either, because he'd meet a friend in town. And, of course, they'd pass the time of day, and they'd talk politics or whatever men talk about, you know. And my dad had many friends. Anybody that he knew was his friend. He really had a host of friends. Of course, he lived in the same area all his lifetime in Merrick and in Platte County. So Ma says, that's why Ma said, oh, he met somebody he knows, and of course they have to talk about everything, what happened, and so on, since they saw each other last. When the children grew up, they got to be teenagers. They were just the same as they are nowadays. They had dates. They had to go to a dance, to a show, or whatever, and who knows where they went. No, the car couldn't talk, and the kids weren't talking either, because when Dad was scolding, why, they told as little as possible. Dad would be wake up, he'd say, well, gosh, I didn't hear the kids come home yet. He'd lay there a while, and the clock in the kitchen would go ding for the half hour. He'd lay there a little while longer, and the clock would strike the hour, and pretty soon the clock would ding again, and still no kids. Believe me, those kids got Hail Columbia the next morning at breakfast. Only some of them didn't come down to breakfast. They got home so late that they slept in. Mom made breakfast, and Dad and the hired man ate breakfast and went their way, and Dad let the kids sleep because, you know, he couldn't trust those half-awake kids on a tractor. They might come into an accident. So he always kept a hired man. Sometimes he had two hired men. When I went there to visit, Ma would say, you know, it's a good thing my health is better. She says, if my health was to be like it was when you were home, she says, I couldn't keep up the way I am. She says, I have to cook for these hired men. And the girls, well, when they get up, they help. But then when they get home, when it's pretty near morning, why, you can't expect very much of them, she'd say. At this time, I think I better tell something about my family. My stepbrother Frank was 21 years old when World War I broke out. And, of course, he was drafted and just about broke Mother's heart. He was her son by her first marriage. In fact, he was the only survivor. She had three daughters, but he was the only son. And the daughters all died in infancy. And Frank was a real, real nice, upstanding young man. He was tall and handsome like his father. And Ma thought the world of him. She just thought, well, now if he goes to war, he'll never come home alive. But he did. He went to camp in Kansas. From there, he went to Germany. And with the ammunition train, he hauled ammunition. He says many a time he'd just get past the place and the road would be blown up behind him. And after the armistice was signed, he was with the Army of Occupation in Germany, and he told how nice the Germans were, because the German people were so nice to the American boys. Fact is, a lot of these American boys were of German descent. Some could even speak German, and they made friends among the Germans, too, and they were well treated. When Frank came home, the armistice had been signed in November, and Frank came home the following June, and he come home, was everybody happy to see him. My dad, he couldn't have been happier if it was a child of his own, but he loved Frank just as though he was his own child. Fact is, he reared him from a child of five, and the other ones, of course, they were all younger, my brothers and sisters. My sister next to me wasn't a teenager, but the others were. They were all teenagers. There was nine of us all together. And Francis was 20, and the rest of them were all teenagers. The youngest, my youngest sister Mary, was six. They was all in steps that way, one next to the other, about 2 years apart. There was Francis and Adam, Lucy, Celia, Martha, Martin, Mary. Mary was the youngest. Mary was quite a gal, I tell you. She ruled the roost among the kids. Of course, she was a pet. She knew it. And whenever Ma went to town, Ma, bring me some candy, she'd say. And she'd always tell the girls, her older sisters, now, you better do what I ask you to, or I won't give you any candy when Mama brings some. we always called our parents Papa and Mama until everybody was grown up. Then they became Pa and Ma. But while the children were little, they were Papa and Mama to everybody. And sure enough, whenever Ma came home, she'd always bring a bag of candy for Mary. Mary would pass the candy around, and she'd remember the ones that she wasn't going to give any to. Oh, she was quite a gal. But you can't make people the way you want them. They'll be what they are. they'll have their own individuality. And same way with when the kids grew older, of course, they had to adapt themselves to their duties. The girls, after I married, after Frank got home from the Army, Dad told me, "Now, Eva, don't set your wedding day until after Frank gets home." He says, "I want Frank to be home when at your wedding." So sure enough, I was engaged to be married at Easter that time. And I made my intended wait until Frank got home before we had our wedding. I want to tell you about my earliest childhood memory. We didn't have a funeral at a funeral home as we do now. The funeral proceeded from the home of the deceased. Of course, my mother was lay in state in her casket in the living room. Grandma led me by the hand, and she said to me in German, "Come give your mother a kiss." She lifted me up, and I bent over and kissed my mother, my dead mother's face. And that's the only recollection I have of my mother, how she looked. I don't remember what she wore. I only remember the deathly pallor of her face, and I carried that memory with me through the years. After that, when we went to church, when we went to cemetery, my dad carried me on his arm. I remember seeing the tears run down his face, and I remember how the people gathered around the graveside. The sisters were singing in Latin, something that I knew nothing about. And I remember how the casket was lowered by the means of straps into the grave. And that's all I remember from the funeral itself. After that, I went home to Grandmother Mason and made my home with her. They had to watch me constantly. I always wanted to go to Mama. And I'd run out the road as if I was going to go home. And they had to watch me. And later on, they still had to watch me. Grandfather and uncles had to watch me because I'd run away. I'd see somebody going down the road, and I'd follow him. I'd see Uncle John going somewhere, and I'd follow him. Pretty soon he got on to me. He made himself scarce. He went to the barn and went out the back door and went wherever he was going to go. But didn't take long. I knew my way around. I'd follow Grandpa Holden to the Sunday school. I'd go to Holden's if I figured that Holden was making cookies. Or I'd go to Tolman's or to Cooley's. I'd even go across the track to people that I lived there. If I thought that Uncle John would be there, then I went there too. And I didn't go home either. Come evening, and the kleine Efi, bist du heim, Grandma would say. And then she'd make the uncles go one to each house and Grandpa to one house. Each one would go to a house to see which one would bring Eva home. And when they brought Eva home, she got a spanking for running away. Poor little thing, she didn't know what she was being spanked for. Of course, it hurt just the same. But next time, she'd do the same thing again. And when my dad had come to visit, Grandma would tell him, "Krieg sein Mutter für deines Kind," she'd say. "Get a mother for your child." Well, that was easier said than done. Who was I going to get to be a mother to my little girl? One day, the answer came. He knew Mr. Vlesik. They went to the same church. And Mr. Vlesik came from the old country, and he spoke German real well. I never knew him, but then I was told that he was versed in German, and he could write it too. And when my dad got to know him, when he saw Mr. Vlesik driving into Columbus, he was driving a hog wagon. He had feeding hogs in the wagon. And behind him was his widow daughter, and she was driving a hog wagon too. And he was taking the hogs to market. And Dad never knew much about Mr. Vletzik's daughter before, but he figured, say, she might be a possibility, you know, to be a mother for my little girl. And sometime later, he heard that Mr. Vletzik was sick, so he went to call on him. And he found out that he had a terminal illness that he'd lay in bed until the day came. And as often as he could, reasonably often as he had time for, he'd go to visit him. Stop there on the way from church or some other time when he'd have time. And one day, Mr. Vlesic said to his daughter, "That Martin that comes to see me is a good man. He'd make you a good husband." That's all he said. He never told her what she should do about it. But come a day when he asked her the question, and they went to see the priest. And the priest made the announcements in church the way it was customary, the way it was prescribed in those days, that a forthcoming marriage had to be announced three times in church. The third announcement came out, and Grandpa Vlesic kept getting worse. And finally, after the calls all were out, my dad and his intended went to the priest to ask his advice. "Well," he says, "it would be better to wait and see. If your father gets better, all right, be quietly married. And if not, why, then come and see me again, and we'll talk about it more." So it didn't take long after that. Her father died. Her father died on July 8. And so they went to see the priest, and he said, "Well, in this case, you better wait a couple of weeks till everything is straightened around, till the funeral is over, and everything is more or less on an even routine again. Then come back and I will talk again." So they did. They went back, and he said, "It's all right. Have a very quiet wedding. No music." So on July 20, they had a quiet wedding, and they didn't have any music. They just, after they got home, they had a meal with only a few friends present. Grandma stood me up on a plank seat, made me sing a German song that she had taught me. My grandmother was a teacher in the old country, and she knew how to do those things. After that, well, we went to our new home then. My stepmother, when she was still Mrs. Tortson, she filed on a homestead not far from where Dad's homestead was. And after all the papers and everything were in order, we still continued to live on Dad's homestead the last of that year. And then when spring came, they started building a new house on Ma's homestead. And after the house was finished, we moved. We lived there, and we went to school, Frank and I. When the school started in December,